Park Place Meeting, Tuesday afternoon, 27th of May, 1975. This afternoon, let us consider together three related questions. Love, sex, celibacy. And in association with these, we shall also consider, insofar as it relates to these subjects, some of the teachings of what is known as the Kundalini Yoga. For the sake of those who perhaps are not sufficiently well acquainted with this, let me just briefly mention that the philosophy of the Kundalini Yoga is a symbolism in terms of seven centers of psychical energy in the body. In Buddhist yoga, they are often reduced to five, and in the innermost teachings of the Upanishads, they have the six centers up to the eyebrows, and then six others in the brain, making 12 centers in all. You see? And these centers, although they are when spoken about, located in the body here and there, think of them more as symbolical associations rather than physical anatomical locations. Then you'll get some real sense out of it all. Transcendent energy creates. We humans procreate. Transcendent creation is a pulse of life, other life, because of which the universe is perpetually renewed at an incredibly swift rhythm. The renewal is not a reshuffling of the old material. Each time, it is a totally new creation. It is non-repetitive. It has no continuity in our sense of the word continuity. This is something quite outside our normal comprehension. But if anybody ever touches this, or, as we might say, some sort of vision of it is granted by grace, then this is what one can say about it. It is non-repetitive, it has no continuity, it is absolutely new every time. And this is creation. Each time what comes into being is the utterly new. With us, there is only a procreative process. Biologically, we are purely procreative. Our so-called cultural creations, art and all the rest of it, are but psychological, intellectual procreations. it will help us to understand the difference between these two if we look at it this way. Whatsoever can be related to a past, just like, say, Haydn, Mozart were symphony writers, Beethoven comes along, others come along, and they also produce symphonies. It is true that those symphonies are distinctive of those who composed them, but they can be related, they bear a relationship to their parentage. There is a continuity of a vision, of inspiration, of expression. So, we recognize a symphony. When there is, that is procreation, just as we recognize a baby as a human being, because we know other human beings of the past. And this is what I mean by using the word procreation. So we humans in our life, throughout our life, are procreative, not creative, in this transcendent sense. That which transcendence creates, we don't know. It always remains the unknown and the unknowable by us. This is our permanent limitation. But all that I can say about it is that it is utterly new. It is the unknown come into being. Now it's very important to appreciate this distinction first. A few days ago, we were talking about the sovereign lord and the sovereign lady. At the transcendent level, the positive and negative, the male and the female are presented. These are the basic archetypal concepts of which man is capable. And he presents these concepts not through mere intellectual speculation, but an intellectual formulation as the result of profound experience in the deepest states of consciousness, which transcend our normal state of consciousness. Therefore, they are archetypal. And you may recall the phrase I used, transcendence, heaven, and earth are in timeless conjugation. This is, as far as I can see, the ultimate origin of love. The love that is beyond all possessiveness, beyond all concupiscence, and so forth. And this is the love that is nearest creation in the transcendent sense. What happens with us? Love has its range of expressions from ordinary possessiveness, passion, and all the rest of it, up to that love which is so selfless that one gives one's whole being to totality, to God, to transcendence. Naturally, spontaneously. And in that giving, whatsoever happens and manifests in the course of that life, there is true self-sacrifice. Meaning, the sanctification of the limited self. Because it has put itself completely in tune with, in harmony with, the transcendent. In that sense, self-sacrifice. Now, the instrumentality of sects is what we witness throughout the organic world, throughout the animate world. And this natural urge is a tremendously powerful urge, because of which, and by means of which, the continuity of species is ensured. Sex is one of the root sources of the most difficult and complicated human problems in the world. We must understand all this very carefully. We must understand how to release the perfect and the right expression of love in all sorts of ways, including the way of sex. You know how in the religious disciplines of the world, celibacy has been extolled as something supremely desirable and fine. And it has been suggested that if one desires to attain the supreme union, one should impose celibacy on oneself. Whatsoever is imposed and therefore raises conflict, constant conflict, repression, neurosis, psychosis, and all the rest of it, defeats its own ends in reality. If and when celibacy emerges naturally in the life, either right from the beginning all through to the very end, or at some stage after marriage and so on, if it emerges naturally and rightly, because of true growth from within, then celibacy is the perfect thing. And it will naturally be there. There'll be no problem involved with it. There'll be no need to exercise a rigid self-repression. Now, let us go back to this point about the centers of psychic energy called the chakras. The physical body as such is a reservoir of immense energy. You all know the famous E equals mc squared equation of Einstein. In connection with the energy locked up in a single atom, the average sized body has approximately 10 to the power 28 atoms in it. One with 28 noughts after it. So now, you will appreciate what that means. That means 10,000 million, 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 million atoms. And if you apply the formula E equals mc squared, you'll get some idea of the tremendous, purely physical energy, electrical and so forth, locked up in the body. In addition to that, there are energies which science has not yet measured and which it is unaware of, subtle energies. Now, these subtle energies are at their simplest level what we call psychical energy. Don't think of them as a separate energy unrelated to physical energy as such, energy in the scientist sense. They are all related. Energy ultimately is all one. These are different forms of which we become aware. Some we can control, all the physical energies we can handle, electricity, magnetism, gravitation, heat, chemical energy, and so forth. We can handle all those, control them, and bend them to our will. Psychical energy, we are only just beginning to learn to handle. And we cannot and should not bend it to our will, but utilize it for the liberation of consciousness so that one can sensibly, matter-of-factly, healthily experience the deep states of consciousness. When the mystic enters into those deep states, all these things happen. He need not know the rationale of it at all. It's not necessary. Great many mystics, provided that they were of that type, all yogis who practice specifically yoga as such in its full sense, including, of course, the discipline of the body through the asanas and breathing and so forth, know about all this, and they can utilize it deliberately. Now, the seven centers start with the center at the base of the spine, which is the storehouse, the starting point of these energies. The next center is at the genitals. The next at the navel. Remember, these are symbolical associations, but they are a little bit more than symbolical too. The next is at the heart. The next is at the throat. The next is between the eyebrows, and this is connected with what has been called the third eye. And the last is the brain itself and above the brain, the thousand-petaled lotus, as it is called. The second center is our concern in connection with what we are considering. The center at the genitals, it is called the Svadhisthana. Sva means self, oneself, and sthana means standing place. The center at the genitals represents the most self-assertive point in our psychophysical being. The supreme act of self-expression, that is to say, of self-assertion, is through the sexual act. Now, this is repetitive, isn't it? It happens in life again and again and again and again, and it is repetitive. It is associated with the increase of desire to enjoy. The most sensational experience is the sexual act. So you see, this craving for sensation is at its peak point, or comes to its peak point through sexuality. Also, it is the supreme assertion of ego, of separate I-hood. This is the important point to bear in mind. Now, this psychical energy, as you go up like this, when you come to the level of the heart, that is the place where you are in relationship to all mankind. The center at the throat is the one that deals with speech. Ordinary, everyday speech, whilst we are mere worldlings. But when the religious life comes to fruition, This is the center associated with speech that is prophetic speech. Now, prophetic speech is not speech which just foretells what will happen next Wednesday or in 1,000 years' time. It is not that sort of foretelling which is referred to. Prophetic speech means the utterance of those words which are least misleading as regards reality and truth, and so stimulate the person who is longing and ready to hear these things that he also wakens up. This is the speech that wakens up a man to his true nature and makes him sense, feel very intensely the fact that transcendence itself is embodied in him. That is the center at the throat. You see why I call it a symbolical association. The speech mechanism is very much associated with all this part of the body. The center at the navel is associated with the idea of digestion. Now, of course, the untrained person thinks of it mainly in terms of digesting food, and it is called the fire of digestion. But remember, this is a psychical center. What does it digest? It digests thought, feeling, all that you learn, all that you experience through the senses. And it converts all that into guiding ideas, to perception of inward principles and so forth. But of course, because the word digestion is used, it is symbolically associated with the navel. Get it? And it's the same with the heart. When your human sense, your true social sense grows and embraces other human beings, society, and all mankind ultimately, you see, you associate it with the heart, the feeling of love for others with your heart. You don't love others with your knee joint or toenail or something. But you always say, I take you to my heart. Not into your nostrils or something. Isn't that so? So you see, it's a symbolical thing, and we must pay greater attention to the symbolism of it and its significance. And as I've already told you, the center here is associated with speech. When this psychical center is ill, that person never stops chattering inconsequential nonsense all the time. When this center is working healthily, then he says only what is necessary, only what is essential, that which is most worthwhile talking about. You will find, for instance, both Eckhart and St. Teresa saying that if we must talk, let us talk about God, for that is the only worthwhile subject talking about. The Buddha says, if you talk with each other, speak about the truth, the doctrine, the supreme teaching, the Dhamma. Otherwise, maintain a noble silence. And so on. Now we come to this chakra here. This chakra means circle, center of energy. Between the eyebrows, it is said to be the center where one hears the word of the master, the teacher. Now, what teacher is this? Is it another person who is giving you religious instruction? No. That you hear with your ears. What you hear with, this is all symbolism, of course, what you hear at this center between the eyebrows is the teacher within yourself. You yourself are simultaneously learner and teacher. If one is serious-minded, if one is devoted to the religious life, whatsoever one gathers from others and understands clearly is rightly learned. And when that is rightly learned, in the supreme sense, it transcends all verbal formulation and conceptual thought. And then this psychical center is really awake and active and conveys, sends forth influences into the whole organism, like as a master, as a teacher would, and it is translated by you in action and thought and speech. So you hear the word of the master here in that sense. And then there comes this final chakra center, the thousand-petaled lotus as such, which is where transcendence symbolically is said to reside. Transcendence is through every single atom of the universe. It's the divine power which is there all the time. So this is symbolically represents the place where the third person of the Trinity resides actually, the brain center. Now, this center is very important, the center between the eyebrows. Let me digress a little bit first, and then we'll come back to this. After we are born, our task is to grow into physical maturity and also mental maturity. As I said the other day, very rarely does a human being grow to mental maturity in the full sense. Most of us grow to physical maturity reasonably well. But we remain adolescent in the mind. Sometimes we are just stuck at the level of the overgrown infant, that's all. But when there is the fruition, and usually they say round about 35, 40, somewhere there, there is mental maturity also. One has realized one's true egohood, which means that one has realized individuality or wholeness, if you like, healthy wholeness within his own psychophysical being. The psychophysical being is my world, specifically, to start with, as such. This is my Garden of Eden. The Garden of Eden means not only the whole universe, but the individual psychophysical being. And the tree of life is this tree, the brain, the spinal cord, and the whole nervous system. Because without it, there'd be no operation of all the experiences through the avenues of sense and of thought. And these are the fruits in the Garden of Eden. And we all eat them, don't we, in order to live. And if we eat them rightly, non-greedily, then there is joy. This is a fact of our life, is it not? So this is our Garden of Eden. Now, when egohood is realized in terms of the microcosm, ourself, the microcosm, our next task is the really great task. As an individual, we are an indivisible whole. That means we are a harmonious whole. But we can't stop there. The other kingdoms of nature For the other kingdoms of nature, that is the peak point. For us, it isn't. It is the starting point of that far wider and more wonderful thing which enables the limited self to transcend all its limitations and embrace the totality itself. In other words, when this person, oneself, has realized wholeness, has realized true individuality, he must transcend all sense of separateness, the isolative self-consciousness has to be, one has to move out of it, emerge out of it. And then, when there is complete and right relationship with one's total environment, true individuality has been fully realized as the true Son of Man. That is the ultimate meaning of individuality. In this awareness of individuality, there is no egoism whatsoever. There is no obtrusion of the self whatsoever. One does not obtrude oneself upon the world. One is in harmonious relationship to it, so harmonious that you just move through it practically unnoticed. And what a blissful condition that can be, if you are unnoticed. You think it out. Right. Now, in the Rig Veda, this state is represented, symbolically represented, by the god Indra. I mentioned, I think, the other day, the god Varuna, who is the lord of virtue. The lord of virtue is operative in us right from the beginning. We have ingrained in us a sense of the categorical imperative. We instinctively know what is right, what is wrong. Our instinct may be only very slightly developed. We can make mistakes. Of course we do. We start at the kindergarten stage and gradually we grow. But Varuna's lordship, this instinctive governance of our life from within through this sense of the categorical imperative, is superseded as we grow to our full egohood and to our ultimate true individuality, when Indra takes over. Indra represents I am, the self. At first, one expresses, remember, all these gods are ourself. They are only ways of talking about ourself, actually. Indra starts off with asserting his self, with I'll use the word conquest. You see? Overcoming difficulties and this, that and the other. But as we grow and this true individuality emerges because of the operation of love, and the operation of love comes through, is symbolically represented in the Rig Veda by the god Mitra. And those of you who know something of Sanskrit and Pali will see this is the word Maitri is related to this, which is loving kindness, which is friendliness. Friendliness, loving kindness, compassion is the mediator between the categorical imperative on the one hand and the egoistic self-assertion on the other hand. So now, when Indra reaches his full expression within us, Indra is declared to be the Lord of Heaven, in the sense that Zeus is Lord of Heaven, or Jupiter is Lord of Heaven, and so forth. You see, or God the Father, the Creator God, is Lord of Heaven. Indra, the I Am. When in Exodus, for instance, you read that the Lord God speaks out of the burning bush and tells Moses, say to the Israelites, when they ask you who you are or what authority, by what authority you come, say, I am, that is Moses, I am that I am, the one and only supreme I am, the selfless self. God, the selfless self. That's the idea. So Indra represents this lordship of heaven and the peak point of spiritualized individuality. The perfect and true individual. Now, there is a fascinating teaching running right through the Rig Veda in connection with Indra. Indra is represented as slaying the demon. You see, we have St. George and the dragon, for instance. Indra slays the demon. And this demon is called the demon of drought. And of course, naturally, when the words are like that, literally, scholars in the last century who were all too inclined to interpret the Rig Veda in rather primitive naturalistic terms said that these people prayed to the god in order that he might slay the demon of drought and the rain would fall and there'd be fertility on the soil. Of course, the general folk must have known that because they experienced it. There are the dear old priests chanting away, and there's no rain at all when rain is required. So the wise ones began to say, oh yes, 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 we understand. Now, what is this drought? What does this demon of drought mean? This drought and this rain, in the Rig Veda, rain, the Lord of rain is Parjanya. And he is in association with Pushan, who is the nourisher. It is all beautiful, you know. When you once understand it, you see what wisdom those old people had. This drought, this demon, withholds the waters. That's why he's called the demon of drought. What are these waters? These are the waters of eternal life. This awakened state of consciousness, where you have transcended the illusion of death as destruction or annihilation. You have realized death as the gateway to the immortal, the infinite, the non-being. The non-being which is alive. Non-being is not total non-existence, a complete blank of vacuity. This is how they use the term non-being in the old religious texts. You see? And this demon is the demon that withholds the waters of eternal life. If those waters flow freely, you are constantly aware in terms of the totality and of the immediate situation in its perfect and right relationship to totality. That is how you are conscious. Now, what is it in our life that emphasizes isolativeness above all? Self-obtrusiveness, ego-assertion, and as we saw earlier, the supreme ego assertion, the separate ego assertion, violent conquest and all the rest of it, is the sexual experience. That is the supreme expression of separate selfness in life. You must work out all the implications of this for yourself. Think it out carefully and you will see how true and how all-embracing this is. Now, this demon of drought, Ahi, Vritra, as he is called. Ahi means the serpent. He's a serpent. Again, remember, St. George and the dragon. And remember that it is the serpent who comes into Eden and tells Eve, oh, you pluck that and eat it, and you will be like God. Now, this is very, very significant and interesting. Ahi Vritra is the demon, the serpent that withholds. And this that withholds the free flow of the waters of life. And this is actually in our lives in terms of sexual expression. Now, Indra does not slay the demon, despite what the Rig Veda says. There is nothing which is slain. There is nothing which is annihilated. Anywhere in the universe, it is always transformed. How does the transformation take place? Through the liberation of oneself from the separative I-consciousness, separative self-consciousness. And as I said earlier, Indra as Lord of Heaven and these two, the center between the eyebrows and the center at the brain, constitute Heaven, the region which is denominated Heaven. And you will find this right in the Rig Veda. It's presented rather skillfully so that the foolish person will just miss the whole thing. The person who is scornful or, sacrilegious in any way and so forth. Only the wise one, only the true devotee who loves truth and transcendence will penetrate into the secret of it. Now, when the waters of life are released, they flow upwards. That means your energies move away from craving for self-assertion, particularly through sexual experience, right into towards the realm of transcendence, this realm here. Indra, as Lord of Heaven, has now liberated the other aspect of the serpent, Ahi Budhnya, Budhnya, the wise one, the knowing one. Is it not in the New Testament, be wisest serpents? What is the meaning of that? Be wisest serpents. The serpent's head symbolizes wisdom. And in the old days, all the way from India to Iran and further west to the shores of the Mediterranean, the serpent's head represented wisdom, the wisdom of the one who had seen the truth, the inner truth, and understood it. See, this is Ahi Budhnya. So when the waters of life are released and they go up there, Indra has not slain Ahi Vritra, the demon, but has made one complete whole of your entire being. And the head of the serpent holds the tail of the serpent in his mouth. He doesn't bite it off, he doesn't destroy it. Why? Because contained energy, rightly contained energy, is the meaning of continence. There is no repression there. There is no domination by the energy, by energy over you. And then there is complete peace. This is the real meaning of sublimation, if you like. Our dear psychologists have yet to arrive at all this knowledge. Because you cannot substitute one thing for another. When you try to substitute, you say to yourself, oh, well, I haven't found a mate. I'll devote myself to the service of the poor. And at the back of your mind is the desire to gain some sort of peace and satisfaction for yourself. Don't demand peace and satisfaction. The bliss of heaven will flood you if you do the right thing. That's all. Don't desire it. If you desire it, you'll miss it. So you see, all these ideas, or you take to art, you take to something else as a substitute. There is no possibility of substitution where a living organism and where a living function is concerned. The kidneys cannot do the work of the heart. It's totally impossible. The brain doesn't do the work of the circulation of the blood. The blood does all that. The brain does its job. You can't substitute the one for the other. So now, Indra as Lord of Heaven, the complete individual, not only whole in terms of the microcosm, your own psychophysical organism, but in complete relationship with the whole macrocosm, the world itself, brings about this state of perfection. All your energies now naturally function in transcendental terms. This particularized expression, the sexual urge and the sexual expression, no longer troubles you. It's at an end. This is a fact. Don't believe what I say. Don't reject what I say. Consider it. Find out through your own experience. Don't repress any energy. Don't give loose rein to it. They are both wrong. Neither resist nor indulge. A very difficult thing to do. It certainly involves considerable tension. You've just got to sit still. And the act of sitting still involves more tension sometimes than rushing about and fighting against something and feeling, I've got rid of that ill. Tomorrow it will come up again. Everything breeds, don't forget. Everything. You can't slay anything, you can't annihilate anything. Not the Lord God annihilates anything. Look at Revelation, the book of Revelation. For 1,000 years, Satan is shut up. But after 1,000 years, well, they say he served a life sentence, let him out. And all the religions teach that thing. The devil is not destroyed. God is too wise to destroy the devil. And the devil has learned enough to know never to tempt God too far. Read Milton's Paradise Lost. There's tremendous wisdom hidden in it. All right. So now what happens? You live naturally celibate. When you are complete and whole as an individual within yourself, when you are complete, in complete and perfect relationship with your environment, you don't desire any longer this particular type of expression. Because this particular type of expression is a limiting expression. This one is chosen. This one is desired. Taken away from the totality. You are mine. I am yours. You see, we are children playing with seashells on the seashore. And here you will find peace. And in this state of peace, your whole mind opens out to transcendent reality in the most extraordinary manner and to the most extraordinary degree. Now, this is the reason why celibacy has been extolled. by great teachers. But it must not be imposed. That's the wrong way. You must understand all this process. At first, of course, it's impossible to fulfill it straight away. Understanding is beyond the intellectual process. Do remember that. Intellect has to be quiet. And in that quiet, and in the simple purity of everyday life, vision and capacity to live by that vision emerges. The waters of life are liberated, and it is they which give you the strength. So now, under such conditions, that person loves in the truest possible sense that man can love. One says, but I am young, I am in my 20s, I'm 18, 19, 20, my blood is hot within me. Of course it is. Live through the whole cycle. By all means, marry, experience the sexual experience, etc., and all its consequences. Don't say no to the consequences. Man is free to act. He can deliberately act. But no man can say no to the consequences of that action. Because that is the way the universe is constructed. And energy is liberated and energy is expressed in action. There is a resultant. This is the actual way the whole universe functions. You can't get away from it. You will get a resultant. So you see, understand all the time. Sex in itself is utterly pure, utterly simple, utterly true. If your approach and your evaluation is simple, true, beautiful, reverential. If there were no sex, would we have Buddhas and Christs and Zarathustras and Beethovens and Shakespeares and whatnot? Totally impossible. All this wonder and marvel of the fine things that have emerged out of the few on this earth through the thousands of years. All that has been possible simply because the mechanism of sex operated and produced these human beings. Without these living beings, where would it all be? Approach it with reverence. Reverence life. Love life, the transcendent. And whatsoever you do in the name of the transcendent, not just holding the name up as an excuse, but as a reality to which you have given yourself, you will find that things will move in terms of your well-being and happiness and fulfillment.